What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Ooh, God. Dang it, I'm good.
6 pounds of pressure, that's all that's required to kill a man. And they say the nightmares never go away.
Your negative review of Sully keeping you up nights, Josh?
Been sleeping like a baby, actually. Just wait till we get around to this week's review.
Old gunslingers do die hard. Chris Pratt in that clip from the new Magnificent Seven remake. Pratt in that one, along with Ethan Hawke, Peter Sarsgaard, and the great Denzel Washington.
Our review of Seven Plus, we're very excited about this. Comedian and Denzel aficionado W. Kamau Bell joins us to share his top five Denzel performances. That and more ahead on Film Spotting.
We have a fun show ahead, a review of the Magnificent Seven remake a little bit later in the show. We are going to couple that with our latest Film Spotting marathon devoted to the work of Spanish-born auteur Luis Buñuel. This is a marathon that listeners, Josh, have been excited about for a while. He's been on the list of potential marathon candidates for quite some time, and I know we are both excited about diving into his work.
I think this is a quintessential Film Spotting show, too, right? Going from the career of Denzel Washington to the work of Luis Buñuel.
And then Buñuel, right?
Just covering it all.
Why not? We'll also get to some poll results on this show with listeners sharing their thoughts on Denzel Washington, his best performance, and their favorite Denzel Washington performance. But first, we get to talk with a true Denzelite, Mr. W. Kamau Bell. Many of you may know Bell for his politically charged stand-up. His new comedy album, Semi-Prominent Negro, was just released this week. He's also the host of CNN's United Shades of America, which just got picked up for a second season, not to mention his live monthly radio show and the politically reactive podcast that he co-hosts. But the reason he's with us today is because he thinks Denzel Washington is the greatest actor of all time, period. And we know this because he co-hosts another podcast called Denzel Washington is the Greatest Actor of All Time, period. Kamau, you are a very busy man. Thank you so much for taking time for us today.
Thank you. When you say it like that, I start to get sleepy.
I bet. It's a lot. How do you pull all of that off?
I mean, I just sort of, you know, I think it's a function of after I had another TV show, Totally Biased, where I was like there for like 12 and 15 hours a day. And then when that was over, I was like, I don't want to ever have to commit that much time to one project ever again. I would like to do lots of things that take up a little bit of time.
Well, that's good to hear. I got another one for you. Okay. Can you add a fourth podcast? I want you to do something on the Forrest Gump sequel, the one that you speculated about in one of your early episodes. When that finally comes out, I just want you to do episodes cataloging that movie. Can you do that for me?
I think I'll have to get rid of another podcast before I add another podcast.
Fair,
the funny thing is, I'm always like going, I could do a podcast about this. And
sure.
Then I look at my wife. She's like, no, you can't.
Exactly.
I'm always coming up with more ideas. I mean, you know, so it's certainly I think there's more podcasts in my future. I just think I'm going to have to suspend some while I
sure,
do that.
Sure. That's a sound move. So when we announced that we were going to do this look back at Denzel Washington's career tied in with the Magnificent Seven review, we heard from a lot of people on social media saying you got to get Kamau Bell on, you got to get someone from that show to talk about Denzel Washington. And the good part was we were way ahead of those Denzelites. We had already reached out to you. So we are very excited to have you on. And that term, Denzelite, all of our best ideas come from our listeners. Did you coin that expression or is that a pre-existing thing that you latched onto?
No, it wasn't. It didn't exist. I came up with the title. I'll take credit for that. I'm a big fan of like crazy long titles. Like we just announced that I have a book coming out that also has a crazy long title. I just think because every other podcast and title's gotten shorter. For example, like Serial is the number one podcast, but you have no idea what that's about when you just say, I'm listening to Serial.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I just feel like I just want a podcast that's very clear what it is so that you know what you're getting into. But then it was actually me and Kevin Avery, we actually shared, it's going to be so much more boring. We shared the same comedy manager for a while, and she was the one who's like, you should call your people Denzelites. And we were like, thank you, comedy manager. This is the... the rare time our comedy manager actually has a good idea. No offense, every comedy manager, but she, Carrie Smith, she was like that. And so that's where it came from. So, but you know, since then the Denzels have come up with lots of things that have been incorporated into the podcast.
So the basic idea for the show, when you set out at the very beginning, you know, just go through Denzel's films, talk about all these performances, has that vision been pretty much accomplished as you're approaching, I think, almost 100 shows now, or has it changed a little bit along the way? And basically, what does it feel like to do this now, this many episodes in?
I mean, I think it really started to shift fairly early on. The idea was that we would review every Denzel Washington movie and therefore prove that he was the greatest actor of all time, period. But very early on, we started people reaching out to us because Denzel is an icon and also a very unique icon. Tom Hanks is also an icon, but there's other white guys. Like, there's this sort of, like, you know, there's like, you know, if Tom Hanks walks into a room and the other side of the room, like George Clooney walks in the room, we got two white guys, two icons in the room. But Denzel's sort of singular in that there's not another actor of his era that holds a similar space. I mean, Samuel Jackson's great, Morgan Freeman is great, but he's kind of the king, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that, like, very early on, people started coming into that. But then it also very quickly turned into a thing that was just generally about diversity in Hollywood. You know, at the time we started doing the podcast, like, Oscar So White kicked up again.
Right.
We also started talking about, like, they're also Project Greenlight. The season of Project Greenlight had all that weirdness around diversity and Effie Brown going, when Matt Damon was like, diversity is on camera, not behind the camera. And I was a big fan of that show, and Kevin's a big fan of Matt Damon, so we had to have a lot of debates about that. And, I mean, I think one of the greatest things that the show has done is that, you know, we talked to Ryan Coogler. Now, he's the director of Rocky, but now we talked about his favorite Denzel movies, but it was a really in-depth discussion about Creed. Like, and luckily our fans have grown with that, and they like that. So we find that we don't actually have to do an episode that's even 50% Denzel for our fans to keep up with it, because Denzel just sort of turns into a discussion about diversity in general.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting how it's evolved to that. So we are going to get to your top five Denzel Washington performances, which I imagine was incredibly difficult considering how big of a fan you are and considering how many great performances he has given. A little bit of setup here, and if I got any of these numbers wrong, I'm sure someone out there will correct me. I looked at his IMDb page. I counted 44 feature film credits. Of those, I've seen 26 of them, so I don't know how good that is or not. I don't know if you've seen all of them or not, Kamau. You can tell us, but I've seen 26 of those 44. He's made 5 with Tony Scott, the director he's worked with the most. Spike Lee 4 times, Antoine Fuqua now 3 times, Ed Zwick 3 times. He, of course, has won 2 Oscars, and I got this from the 538.com article, speaking of those think pieces, Kamau, the 4 types of Denzel Washington movies. They have him ranked 29th all time in terms of box office. His films have made over $2.2 billion domestically. So just a little bit of background there. Let's actually go ahead and get to your picks. And how did you even begin to come up with your list?
Well, we talked about this in the podcast. I actually learned this from people coming on the podcast, because some people, we make everybody come on and say, what are your top 5 favorite Denzel Washington movies? And very quickly, people were like, do you mean favorite performances or favorite movies? Like, there would be this sort of like split between a Denzel Washington movie I enjoy or a performance that I think is transformative and revelatory. And I never hadn't thought of it that way. So only through other people coming to the podcast, you like Dave Zirin, who's the great political sports reporter, came on with 2 lists. And now it's a pretty common thing for people to do that. And or Ryan Coogler, we call it Cooglering, who would have like tied for number 5 is 4 movies.
I can relate.
Happens on this show.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's called Cooglering.
Okay.
So, yeah. So, for me, like, my favorite movies are pretty different than this list of my favorite performances.
Okay, really?
Yeah. No, there's only one. Well, there's 2. I guess that's not very good. But, yeah, there's 3 on here that a couple I would have put on my list of favorite movies, but then later through doing the podcast, I'm like, I'm just saying that so I sound smart. It's not actually true.
Yeah, well, just to jump in real quick, I'm curious, because we may sprinkle in our choices. I know we did come up with our top 5 as well. Josh, did you end up in a similar place, or are you like me and kind of have your 5 favorite Denzel movies that also happen to correspond with your favorite performances?
I went with performances, but for me, the tough thing was we have a poll going on right now between best Denzel performance or another poll asking for your favorite. So this is a whole nother can of worms come out that you can get into. And so I got turned around in that a little bit, which has been really tough.
Yeah, and we are going to get to those results later, but I guess I'll give a little bit of a spoiler. A good example there, I think, I don't have him in front of me, but Malcolm X, I think, won for best performance, but Training Day wins for favorite, right? And there is a big distinction between those 2 performances.
For sure. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Like, people there's a sense, and we talk about this in the podcast, there's a sense black people really like to not like Training Day because, like, you know, he's just playing a bad cop. But you cannot deny the immense fun it is to watch him in that performance.
You can
sort of get on your high horse and go, I don't think it's good that you won an Oscar for that. And that's also a discussion we can have. But I'm somebody who came around to that and be like, this is just a good – I mean, it's like he is so – he chews up every bit of scenery. And it's so fun to see an actor like that get the – be allowed to sort of just run all over the screen. Whereas Malcolm X, he literally does the right thing.
Yeah.
And it's a great performance. But it's like if honestly, like I always think of it this way. If there's two TVs or on one TV there's two different movies playing, Malcolm X or Training Day, that's how you figure out your favorite, the one you go, well, I got to go watch this. And I'd watch a little bit of Malcolm X, but eventually I can get to Training Day before he says King Kong.
Exactly. Okay. So
did either of those make your top five then? Both of them maybe?
No, we talked about again. So this is top five performances.
That's right.
Performances.
So number five, I'm going to say Hurricane.
Okay.
Hurricane is – I used to be one of my favorite movies, but if you watch the movie, it's a little bit heavy-handed. And they also have to cover a lot of time. And so it's just that thing where movies have to cover a lot of time. They sort of like – things sort of get attenuated. But that movie did bring me to read about Reuben Hurricane Carter a lot. So – but his performance in that movie, the fact that he plays a guy from like 18 to like, I don't know, 60. Like, and it's not totally unbelievable. And the fact he was 45 years old and ripped in the boxing scenes.
Yeah.
And it has a classic Denzel Washington line. I'm 50 years old, which me and Kevin Abrams say.
The quivering lip, everything. Yeah.
50 years old. I've been locked up for 30 years.
It's funny about that movie because in that poll question that we're referencing, we gave like the top six answers we thought would be the most common, and we didn't list Hurricane among them. And then we had other where people could write in, and Hurricane scarcely got mentioned. Do you think that there is a valid reason or any reason that you can come up with why that movie for some reason just hasn't held the same esteem over time since it came out?
I mean, I think it has the biopic problem that, like, you know, it's hard to sort of like when you really need to cover a person's whole life, it's hard to do a great job with that or a thorough job with that. Like, you know, every biopic should actually be like a season of television, like where it's like, you know, instead of like cramming it all in.
Agreed.
Also, I think it got a lot of heat at the time.
I remember that. Yeah.
Because it played a little fast and loose with some of the facts, which I felt like. Did we all see A Beautiful Mind? Was that guy like a closeted reprobate? Like, you know,
exactly.
Like, but the movie he was just a crazy math genius. I feel like that was to me like a little bit of institutionalized racism, where like, oh, so this black guy gets heat for playing fast and loose, and then not as fast and loose in the facts as other biopics do regularly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it sort of that affected it, and also I think it's a little bit like if you want to watch Hurricane, you might as well watch Malcolm X because it's basically a better version of that movie. You know, it's a black guy.
Well, he has been in a number of biopics, so you know, maybe once those start getting ranked in people's minds, Hurricane falls to the bottom.
Yeah, might be.
I just think Hurricane's not really, he's great in it. It's not, I mean, and I say this very, it's not a ton of fun. Like, I think so. It's not like, like Malcolm X, even though it's tragic, seeing him be Malcolm X is fun. It's just, it's amazing, and you're really like, oh, this is one of the greatest things I've ever seen. So Hurricane is great, but I think it maybe doesn't age as well as these other movies. But his performance is absolutely top-notch.
Yeah, a clear one there, as you were saying, that would fit here into your top five performances, but not your top five Denzel movies. What about your number four?
My number four, I'm going to say A Soldier Story.
Love it.
Yeah, Soldier Story is like the first, I think, I mean, maybe he did the carbon copy movie first, but we don't really count that.
Yep.
But yeah, Soldier Story is really like a great movie because it's a murder mystery, and Denzel starts out being what you would think is like, oh, this guy's got nothing. And then eventually the reveal, it's like, oh, this guy's got a lot more than I expected.
Yeah.
You know, no spoilers. And I think that like, it's sort of interesting that he ended up being such a leading man because it's really that is a really character performance. Like, it's not dominated by him being like the best looking, handsome guy. Like, he's sort of a nerd, for lack of a better word. He's wearing glasses and he's sort of thought as like not being really worthy of anyone's respect.
That's
a lot
true.
Of movies.
Yeah.
Where are you from, Peterson?
Hollywood, California. By way of Alabama, sir. You see, I enlisted in 42. I thought we'd get a chance to fight, sir.
Did you know the sergeant well?
No, sir. He was already with the company when I got assigned, and PFCs and sergeants, we don't mix too well, sir.
You played ball for him?
Oh, yes, sir. I played shortstop.
And did you like the sergeant?
No, sir. You see, well, it goes back to the team, sir. Stone ass felt that.
Stone ass?
Well, I'm the only one who called him that, sir. Sergeant Waters, sir. Didn't mean no offense, sir.
Leading actors don't normally start out that way. They normally start out as leading. You know, it's like it's a real character role. Later, he would have been cast in the role that Howard Rollins would have played if they'd done that movie again.
Well, that's right. He kind of is in Courage Under Fire, right?
Yeah, yeah. He does the same thing. So I think it's really a testament to the fact that that sometimes in the modern era, we forget that Denzel, if he was less good looking, he would have been a great character actor.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
He's too good looking, too tall, too good looking to be a character actor. And also, I think that he actually was in a soldier's play, which is why he played the same role in the movie. He was in the soldier's play. And we had David Alan Greer on the podcast, who was also in a soldier's play, that also starred Samuel L. Jackson, was also in that play in New York, and told great stories of like actors in the late 70s and early 80s, those guys all being on in a play together. It was amazing.
Yeah, that movie is one. It came out in 84. I was 9 or 10 years old then, and I watched it all the time. For some reason, I think my dad exposed me to it, and I became obsessed with it because it would be on HBO all the time. And so I would just see it constantly, and I do remember him very vividly from that film. And then I remember getting into high school my senior year and having to write a paper for an English class on the Melville short story Billy Budd that was made into a movie in the 60s with Peter Ustinov. And that's basically a soldier story is basically Billy Budd, but set obviously in the army. So yeah. And I love that movie and that book too. So that's one that has always stuck with me. It's a great choice. What about your number three?
Number three, Glory. I sort of struggle, like maybe it should be higher. I mean, that's when for a lot of black people, he became like, oh, so we're going to put him on a postage stamp someday. That he's going to be like, he's going to get his birthday off one day in black households. He's going to be on the back of Baptist Church fans. All for that scene where he plays a very complicated character. Again, a character. It's something a character actor would do because he's not the good guy in the movie. He's a very complicated character. And a character you sort of want to hate, but Denzel Washington's charisma sort of makes it that you're like, I want to hate you, but I can't.
Mm-hmm.
And glory tier is a thing. Like you can say to somebody, I almost had a glory tier. And people, because of that movie, the fact that he cried out of one eyeball, I mean, it became like this thing where it's like, not only is it a great performance, but he's doing a magic trick. Like, and I mean, it's to this day, you can say to most black people of, you know, probably go glory tier and they know what you're talking about. And many people know what you're talking about. But I think it's just like, it was when he became bigger than just an actor in that movie. And that's a movie, again, you don't get to see a movie where he's acting up against Morgan Freeman and Andre Brower, and you know, big ups for what's his name, Ferris Bueller in that
Matthew
movie.
Broderick, well, yeah,
A for
Matthew
effort. Broderick. Let's say,
I'd say a lot of white guys would have been mad at that they were on screen. Like I would have been like, move out of the way so I can get to them. But he sort of plays a very good like, I'm not supposed to be here, but. Yeah. I have a lot of respect for Matthew Broderick. Watch that movie. I'm like, he could have been blown off the screen, and he sort of let his naivete allow him not to be blown off the screen. Glory. That's when he becomes a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, button up that collar. Suck in that gut. Tuck in them big black lips. Lighten your skin. Shrink up that nose.
I don't have to listen to this.
Where you going, boy?
Let me buy.
Let you buy. Let you buy. Let me tell you something, boy. You can march like the white man. You can talk like him. You can learn his songs. You can even wear his suits. But you ain't never gonna be nothing to him but an ugly-ass chimp in a blue suit. Oh, you don't like that, do you?
No.
But what we gonna do about it? You want to fight me, boy? Huh? What you gonna do about it? You want to fight me, don't you?
There's no denying, though, that Denzel just manhandles that movie. I mean, he's not really supposed to be the one thing you come out of it thinking about.
But you do.
And,
you're right.
And you do. You absolutely do. I think it's the potent combination of swagger and anger that he has in that role. And it's – you're right. That is a much more – watching scenes from Glory again, it's a much more complicated character than I remember in my memory. It's not the sort of postage stamp character that we might think of. He's really complicated and troublesome and conflicted. And man, making a breakout performance out of something like that takes a special sort of skill.
Yeah, and that was his first Oscar. And I think also the other thing about that, as we talk about the current era of like people don't understand, how can Colin Kaepernick say such mean things about America and say he still likes America? Well, it's complicated. And I think, you know, like go watch Glory. It's really good. Like Denzel ends up basically showing pride in his in the flag, you know, like while at the same time hating everything the flag has created. So yep. I think it's a for a black person, it's like that character is very relatable. It's like I totally get that. Like, you know, it's not love it or leave it. It's like hate it and fix it.
Yeah, and that's funny because we just got done talking about last week on the show, Born on the 4th of July, so this topic seemed very relevant. And then I just actually watched Glory for the first time. Somehow in the 80s, I missed it. I knew that I had to cross this one off before I talked to you or talked to anybody about Denzel Washington. And yeah, his performance is, there's no doubt it's a standout. And that interesting combination you pointed out, Josh, of the kind of swagger and anger and that sense of righteousness is something we get that really comes through in a lot of really good Denzel performances.
Oh, yeah.
But then on the flip side of that are the ones where it always feels like he's repressing that. And that's fascinating too. And that comes through actually a little bit, I think, in his character in The Magnificent Seven, the more quiet, reserved ones, but there's always something underneath the surface you're just waiting to spoil over, to bubble over.
I think that struggle over the idea of righteousness is like, if you look at Denzel Washington as an auteurist actor, mm-hmm. like what's the through line in almost every one of his performances? It's that, and you see it right here in Glory.
Yeah, great pick. Number two.
Number two, we're going with Training Day, which Training Day could easily be number one, but I don't want to get black people mad at me. So I'm going to say number two. Look, it's Training Day. I mean, that movie only works as well as it does because you have a history of Denzel Washington's career behind it to sort of know where he came from. And so I think if he had done Soldier Story and then Training Day, you'd be like, oh, okay, so he's just kind of a jerk, you know, like, but because we'd had a history of Denzel Washington being like this sort of like, you know, post Malcolm X, like he's our savior. He's black, you know, he's black Jesus or Jesus, as some people say.
There you go.
You have this sort of history of him being like this sort of like he's our avatar for positive black male role models. And then in Training Day, it's like a meta performance because we're like, how you're watching the character of Alonzo do all these horrible things. We're like, Denzel, how could you do this?
Yeah. Like,
and at the same time, again, his charisma comes through as that character given to another actor would just be like, you know, it would have been like Bad Lieutenant where Harvey Keitel, you're just like, I just hate you, like, you know, like, which is fun to watch, but it's not a box office hit. I think it's Denzel's charisma that turns that into a box office hit. And again, shout out another white guy, Ethan Hawke. I condescended his performance, but the more I've seen it, I'm like, you have to be a strong actor to put up with that guy, and you know, for the whole movie.
Last year, to be truly effective, a good narcotics agent must know and love narcotics. In fact, a good narcotics agent should have narcotics in his blood.
What are you gonna smoke that?
Nope, you are.
Hell if I am.
Yeah. Yeah. You not?
No.
Why, you a Mormon or something? You a Jesus freak?
No, man, I'm not losing my job.
This is your job.
I can't do that.
Smoke it.
No.
This ain't a test. Just take a hit. Take a hit.
Man, listen, I became a cop to stop people.
Yeah, yeah, blah, 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 blah. It's not a review board and it ain't cocaine. Take a hit.
No, man.
I think, in general, a lot of us, I've noted this recently, because I think Ethan Hawke's had an amazing run over the past couple of years in particular. I think a lot of us condescended to him for some reason as not a heavyweight enough actor, and I think he's proven us all wrong here recently.
I like the idea of his performance in Training Day being a meta performance that in the way you talked about, but also because when I watch it, I feel like he's screaming at Oscar voters the whole time. It's like, I don't know what you've been waiting for, but fine. Here it is. Berates them into giving him his best actor Oscar, which they finally did.
Yeah, as the great comedian Greg Proops said, and it was one of those jokes I wish I'd written, and he said this before he won the Oscar, he's like, and finally they're going to give this guy who's played Biko and Malcolm X and Reuben Hurricane Carter, they're going to give him an Oscar for playing Pimptatious McGee.
That's pretty much it.
Several times. I was just like, that's good. I wish I'd written that.
That's so great. All right, well, what's better than Training Day? What's your number one?
Performance. Malcolm X is the Michael Jordan of Denzel Washington movies. Like, it's just like you can sort of argue against it for fun as not being the greatest, but that's the greatest performance because it's also the most important performance. Because when he took the movie Malcolm X, there was a lot of talk of like, can he pull this off? There's a lot of, like, amongst the black community, he's too dark skinned to do this. He doesn't look enough like Malcolm. We should get a lighter skinned guy. There's all this sort of talk about this book is impossible. Spike Lee's doing it. Is Spike Lee going to do a good job? Is he able to do an epic movie like this? You know, Spike Lee ran out of money, and then like black celebrities gave him money to finish the movie. It all is tied into also the fact that it was one of the first movies that sort of that went viral before it came out through the X caps and the X shirts that people were like people like Michael Jordan were wearing. Like, so the movie marketing became a part of the story. Like, I had an X shirt and an X cap, and I didn't even wear baseball caps. But it was just like it was a phenomenon, a cultural phenomenon that now movies try to replicate. Every movie tries to replicate sort of like a viral marketing campaign. And Spike Lee sort of pioneered that with Malcolm X. And that movie, without that movie, I wouldn't have read the autobiography of Malcolm X when I did. I was like, oh, I should probably read the book before I see the movie. And that book changed my life. And Denzel, there's moments in that movie, if you've seen a lot of pictures of Malcolm X and you see Denzel in that movie, he looks like Malcolm X, which doesn't make sense because he doesn't look like Malcolm
no,
X.
No, you're absolutely right.
And he's always talked about like he's a very spiritual, religious man. He keeps it on the down low a lot of times. But it's like he really feels like he was channeling Malcolm X. And I'm like, I don't know enough about that to know if that's true. But there's times in that movie you go, it doesn't make sense. He looks like Malcolm X, even though he doesn't. And I mean, one of the most quoted speeches in my life that we use as part of the rating system on the show is, oh, I say and I say again, you've been had, you've been took, you've been hoodwinked, bamboozled, led astray, run amok. This is what he does. I just did a very poor job of it. that speech is like, again, it's like it's just one of the things where you can say that to a certain generation of black people. They go, yeah, Malcolm X. And the funny thing about that, there's no evidence that Malcolm X ever said that, the real Malcolm X. But it's one of the most quotable. And again, we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. There's no evidence that the real Malcolm X said that I've ever seen. But Denzel said it. So now it's one of the most popular Malcolm X quotes. Like, he sort of took over the legacy of Malcolm X in that movie in a way that you realize is so gigantic when you compare that to, and not that I'm putting down his performance, but like Will Smith and Ali, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's not bad.
I think there's something similar between those two performances, though. And yeah, I mean, Denzel's is far superior, but both are taking actors who are known for their charisma, right? They just have this molten hot charisma and playing figures from history who had the same thing. And so that could go really poorly, but somehow I think Will Smith pulls it off, but even more so Washington, they managed to morph those different types of charisma into something that's wholly new, like what you're talking about, Kamau, where those speeches are considered, it's not Denzel, it's not Malcolm X, it's this wholly new thing that is so powerful, it has this pop cultural cachet now that we all recognize.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you like it really is. Every election year, these politicians are sent up here to pacify.
That's right.
They're sent here and set up here by the white man.
That's right.
This is what they do. They send drugs in Harlem down here to pacify us. They send alcohol down here to pacify us. They send prostitution down here to pacify us. Why, you can't even get drugs in Harlem without the white man's permission. You can't get prostitution in Harlem without the white man's permission. You can't get gambling in Harlem without the white man's permission. Every time you break the seal on that liquor bottle, that's a government seal you're breaking. Oh, I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked. Bamboozled. Led astray.
Yeah, and I, like I said, I think, like, and again, not, I think the Ali movie, like, it didn't, I mean, it works fine, but I don't think it was, like, as transcendent as some of the stuff for reasons that aren't to do with Will Smith. Agreed. I don't want to put it on him. Yeah. I just think with the Will Smith performance, I feel like there's a difference between sometimes in that performance, I can hear him doing the impression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, completely.
Whereas with Denzel, I don't hear Denzel in there. Not at all. Like, oh, this is just footage of Malcolm X they got. I thought he was more light-skinned. Anyway, let's keep watching.
You know. Well, so with Malcolm X at number one, really that perfect crossover then, the synthesis of great movie and great performance. And I'm with you completely. Josh, were you number one Malcolm X as well in your list?
I had He Got Game as my number one Denzel performance, and that's only because I revisited a fair amount of it in the last week. I had forgotten how good that movie
is. Yeah, I've got it at number four.
Oh, good. Yeah. Excellent. I mean, this is, again, like in Glory, a really complicated, in some ways nasty guy, far nastier than the character in Glory, but the shades he brings to that in He Got Game, and plus that Dr. J. Afro, I mean, that might have put it over the top for me at number one.
Yeah. I mean, that movie is amazing. That's a movie that I haven't seen as much as the other Denzel movies. And I think that it's like a classic Spike Lee movie, and that it's kind of a Trojan horse. You think it's about one thing, but it's really about another thing.
Absolutely.
When I rewatched his performance, the movie for the podcast, I was like, oh yeah, this is way better than I remembered. And we had Spike Lee on our podcast, and it was a great episode. We did like all talked to him about all the movie times he'd worked with Denzel. It's also a thing where I told Spike, like, I wouldn't have picked – when you had Ray Allen in that movie back in the day, I was like, why this guy? And then Ray Allen ends up being one of the greatest basketball players in the history of all time, period. Like, right. Like, oh, you're smarter than me, Spike Lee. That's why.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. I know he's great. Kevin Avery, one of Kevin Avery's Denzel, who's the co-host of my podcast, one of his favorite Denzel scenes in a movie is in He Got Game when he hits a guy in the throat.
Oh, man. And he is so vicious there. And I love the touch at the end where – and this speaks to the layers of his character. He runs. You know, it's not like this big victorious, he is the tough guy. He just knocked this guy out. But then he also realizes what that means for him and his life. And he takes off running down the street. I love that touch.
Yeah, no, it's like it's at that moment where he hits the guy goes down. He also says, like, keep breathing, breathe. And then
that's such a Denzel moment. Yeah.
I don't really want to hurt you, but, but also, oh, shit, I'm going to get out of here.
Exactly.
But
yeah,
it's, I mean, there's so many, like, I'm sort of upset that I didn't get Man on Fire on here, because I think that's that's the thing that I keep going.
That's a good transition maybe real quick as we consider any other movies you did strongly consider or ended up as honorable mentions, as we've mentioned a couple of the ones for our list, and we're certainly not going to go into any detail at this point because you've done an amazing job illustrating why Denzel's so great in your picks. But I had at number 5 Deja Vu, because I felt like I needed a Tony Scott film on here, and their collaboration being obviously the one that he's collaborated with that director the most. And I was thinking about it just in terms of Man on Fire or some of these other titles, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. If you had another movie star in any of those roles, say someone like Bruce Willis, who I think is a fine movie star, would he have ever been able to bring an ounce of the emotional complexity and depth, that righteousness, but then couple that with that kind of vulnerability or that humanity that he brings that makes those movies rewatchable? Denzel is the reason why. I mean, Tony Scott, I know a lot of us have come to appreciate his filmmaking more over the years, but it's Denzel that makes those movies worth revisiting, I think. What about you, Kamau? You sound like you're not a big fan of that film.
Of Deja Vu?
Yeah.
I enjoy that movie. It's one of those things where it's like there's some movies, and this is true of all actors, where I think he's great in that movie, and I think Denzel does elevate a movie beyond where it can normally – like you can take a bad movie and it's like, you know, it becomes better with Denzel. That one to me just feels very much like – I like watching that movie, but if it had been Tom Cruise, I wouldn't have stepped near it. You know, like I wouldn't have – like it's just like the movie in and of itself to me is sort of, it's a very sort of mainstream Hollywood vehicle.
Sure.
Which I'm not anti that, but it doesn't – it feels like – and Denzel's got a lot of those on his thing where you're like, this could have been – I think he brings a lot to it, but it could have been anybody.
Yeah.
Whereas like Malcolm X is either Denzel or nobody else. Like, you know, Training Day is either Denzel or it becomes a much different movie. Deja Vu might have been a bigger hit with Tom Cruise because he's a white guy and we tend to enjoy white guys running around after explosions more than we like black guys doing it. You know what I'm saying?
So, no, very valid. Though, to my point, I don't think I would want to go back and rewatch the Tom Cruise version, but Denzel makes me...
And I don't mean to condescend to Tom Cruise either. I mean, Jack Reacher, I'm looking forward to the sequel when I see it.
Aren't we all? Right? So real quick, I'll just list them. Number 4, I had He Got Game. Number 3, I had Devil in a Blue Dress. And this is one where if I was just ranking the movies, it might be lower. But I love his Easy Rollins. I love every bit of that. And, of course, love Don Cheadle as Mouse as well. Number 2, Inside Man. And number 1, Malcolm X. So 3 of the Spike Lee movies in there in my top 5. What about you, Jack?
I've got Devil in a Blue Dress right there at number 3, too. I think that speaks to his timelessness. I mean, he slips into that, what is it, about 1948
million. Post-World War
II. So easily. And that puts him up there with the all-time actors when you can do that, shift eras. So I had Flight at 5, a movie I'm very mixed on, but man, he just about pulls that thing out in the last 10 minutes. Isn't quite able to. Malcolm X, I've got at 4 because I do really like him so much in Devil in a Blue Dress. At 3, that might be his sexiest performance, Devil in a Blue Dress.
For sure.
Glory, I've got up there at number 2. And then, as I mentioned, He Got Game is number 1.
Okay, so Kamau, any other thoughts on any of those or any of the other films that you regret that you couldn't squeeze in there?
Yeah, I mean, there's a film that I've really come to respect a lot because of the podcast, and that when I rewatched it, I was like, oh, this is even more important now. I think it's just sort of, and I think a lot of people have made me respect it more, but I watched it and I was like, this film still holds up. That it just didn't make it. I just didn't, and if I put it in, I would have just been trying to sound smart, but Philadelphia is maybe the most interesting Denzel Washington movie that there is. Like, it's just the fact that he, in the course of the movie, goes from homophobe to not homophobe, and he's a black man, which in the black community, there's a lot made out of our us being more homophobic than other people, which I don't believe to be true. But Tom Hanks gets the credit for Philadelphia, but Denzel's character is the anchor of the movie.
Yeah, I agree. I actually just saw parts of that movie recently on TV, hadn't seen it in years, and some of those courtroom scenes are fantastic, and Denzel is why, and Jonathan Demme's camera, and those point of view shots where he's talking right to us as the jury, as the audience, I think are really effective. Yeah. You're right, Denzel is great there. He also worked, of course, with Demme on The Manchurian Candidate, which maybe not as good as the original Manchurian Candidate, but still a quality
film. I like that one. I like that one.
Meryl Streep is amazing in Manchurian Candidate. Yep. It's just, which is funny. That's one of, we had Spike Lee list his top five Denzel Washington movies, but we wouldn't let him put his own movies in there.
Oh, man.
And so he listed Manchurian Candidate, which I was like, oh, interesting. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, we will definitely link to that episode in our show notes at filmspotting.net, the one with Spike Lee, and link to your podcast. And I can't say how much fun this was. Thanks so much for taking the time again, Kamau.
Thanks, Kamau.
Thanks for having me. Happy to do it.
This isn't an election. This is a coup. This is, in our own country, a regime change in our own country.
Ben, don't. Ben.
This is rich people, Manchurian Global, funding bad science to put a sleeper in the White House. And that's what's going on, Rosie. That's what's going on.
Our thanks again to W. Kamau Bell for that conversation. I don't know about you, Josh, but I could listen to Kamau talk about Denzel Washington all day long, which I think means I have a new podcast in my regular rotation.
Never mind Denzel. Can we just have him on for all of our top fives?
I'm fine with that. The rest of the show, maybe. He can review Magnificent Seven in our place. His new comedy album, Semi-Prominent Negro, again, it's out now on the Kill Rockstars label. You can get more information about Kamau and all of his projects at wkamaubell.com. And you can find Denzel Washington is the Greatest Actor of All Time, period, podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Denzel's performance in The Magnificent Seven didn't quite make the cut for any of our lists, though I would say he's hardly the problem with the film. Our review is next. Stay with us.
Just hard because there's just all these conversations we have to have because racism is just, you know, it's bad right now. We have to have all these people of color. We have to have all these conversations. And unfortunately, we have to have them with white people. It'd be easy if we could just have them with each other. There's racism, right? There sure is. Papa, see you later. And I'm not mad at you, white people. Let me be clear. I'm not mad at you. You're not the ones who are here. You're some of the good ones. You're not like the rest. You speak so well. All I'm trying to say is... you're like, hey, that started out as a compliment, but then it hurt my feelings. I know, I know. I learned it from you, Dad. I learned it from you.
Pierce Patchett.
He takes a cut of our earnings and invests it for us. Doesn't let us use narcotics and he doesn't abuse us. Can your policeman's mentality grasp those contradictions?
He had you cut to look like Veronica Lake.
No. I'm really a brunette. But the rest is me. And that's all the news that's fit to print.
Josh, it is unfortunate that we have to do these little tributes here on the show. We've had quite a few of them recently, it seems, but we did get news of director Curtis Hanson's passing just after recording last week's episode. He was 71, best remembered for 1997's L.A. Confidential. Probably you heard Russell Crowe's Bud White there with Kim Basinger's Lynn Bracken in that clip. And if you look at the films he made from 92 to 2012, there's maybe less than stellar bookends. You got The Hand That Rocks the Cradle and The River Wild, 92, 94. I actually haven't seen either of those movies. And I know some people do like those movies.
I like The River Wild,
thrillers,
quite a bit.
But Missed by Me. And then you end with Chasing Mavericks in 2012, the surfing movie, I think, with Gerard Butler that I think both of us missed.
I missed
that one. We both skipped that one. And then Lucky You in 2007, the poker movie with Eric Bana and Robert Duvall, that I have actually seen over the years on HBO. And it's not particularly good, unfortunately.
No, I think I saw it right around the time I was revisiting Heart 8.
Okay.
And that did not help.
No, I can't imagine it would have helped. But in the middle there, in 97, L.A. Confidential, Wonder Boys in 2000, 8 Mile in 2002, and In Her Shoes in 2005, which is maybe my favorite Curtis Hanson film, honestly, right after L.A. Confidential. That's how much I love In Her Shoes. Those
good.
Four movies are fantastic.
Well, I feel better then about saying 8 Mile might be his favorite film of mine. And
really?
This is, you know, having not revisited any of these, including L.A. Confidential, probably since it came out. And I know that is considered far and away his best. But I thought 8 Mile was fantastic. The
it
sense
is.
Of place, the performance he gets out of Eminem. And I think it's just interesting to look at the different settings and milieus that he did explore throughout his career and manage, you know, the term that's given to that is professionalism, but I don't know if that's always fair. I mean, it does take quite considerable skill to make movies of this high quality that are set in such a wide array of places and with different people.
Well, and In Her Shoes as well, a movie about sisters with three women in those leads, of course, Cameron Diaz and Toni Collette and Shirley MacLaine. And it would be very easy to just assume that a female filmmaker made that movie, maybe someone like a Nora Ephron, and you wouldn't necessarily ascribe that to a male filmmaker. But you know what? Someone like Curtis Hanson certainly wasn't bound by any restrictions like that, and he let all three of those performers do what they do best in that film. And yeah, if you want to make me cry really fast, all you have to do is show me a couple clips from In Her Shoes. So just certainly wanted to take a moment there to pay a little tribute to Curtis Hanson. We also wanted to promote the fact that we've got even more free movie passes to give away here on Film Spotting for our listeners who are lucky enough to be here in the Chicagoland area. The Birth of a Nation, the movie that everyone's anticipating. It opens on October 7th here in Chicago and elsewhere. And on Monday, October 3rd, there's going to be an advanced screening of it in the evening here in Chicago. We've got passes to that. And Josh, we don't really promote this very often because it's hardly worth promoting. And it doesn't happen all that often, but we will actually be at this screening too. So if you win the passes, and
chances
you see
are.
Us,
chances
yeah, chances are. Actually, now that I say it, maybe we won't
well,
be there.
Well, unless we're fortunate enough to get a chance to see it even earlier. So we'll
see. That's right. There is that possibility, but we were intending to be at this screening. So who knows? If you see us there, please do say hi. Certain Women, the latest from Kelly Reichert, that is going to be on October 17th. It opens on October 21st. And then Andrea Arnold's American Honey, it opens October 7th on Friday. And we've got passes to give away to that during its run here in Chicago. So not an advanced screening, but you can go see it anytime after it opens. All of this info is available at our website, filmspotting.net.
We're getting into the really good time of year, aren't we? When you see those three titles are what's coming up in the next few weeks, Birth of a Nation, Certain Women, American Honey, all ones hugely anticipated by me from the beginning of the year.
I'm with you. More promotional housekeeping to get out of the way. We've been mentioning it. We want to keep mentioning it. The Chicago Podcast Festival taking place here in mid-November. Three different Chicago venues. We are going to play Shubas with Film Spotting SVU. Matt and Allison will come in from New York. I hope that their demands for the green room and stuff aren't too intense. And
should we tell them there isn't a green room?
I don't want to tell them that yet.
Not yet. Okay.
Let's just hold back
wait
a little
till they're
bit.
On the plane.
They have to get here, Josh. So let's hold off on that. But we're going to be doing that show on Friday, November 18th. And the Next Picture Show, another part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts, they're going to be doing a live taping on November 19th. Tickets are on sale now. You can get them at chicagopodcastfestival.org.
We're going to be at Shubas, right? Is that
indeed.
Where? Yeah. So I don't know for sure. And maybe Tyler Green, who's our live event producer helping us put this on, will correct me, but I don't think that's a huge place. Is that sound right to you? I mean, certainly I think it's smaller than some of our previous live
venues. Yeah, definitely smaller
venues.
Than the Music Box. I want to say
well,
that
yeah, than the, music
the
box,
main stage
for sure.
Got into the 200, 220, but this one is probably less. Yeah, maybe 150.
So point being, if you're interested in this, you might want to move on tickets.
There you go. Josh is like a real radio host.
Well,
he's pushing tickets. Get them fast.
I don't want people to be disappointed.
Okay. Well, are people going to be disappointed by Josh Larson's foray into book publishing?
Oh, time will tell. Yes, I get to promote a little bit myself here. Apparently, the book I've been working on, Movies Are Prayers, is available for pre-order.
Nobody told you.
On Amazon. Well, this is great. Someone on Twitter, Abdul Malik Ryan, he's the Muslim chaplain at DePaul. He points out, hey, pre-order this, looking forward to it, and tagged me. I was like, oh. And I thought, is this sort of a fake posting? But no, I checked with the publisher. It is official. So if you're at all interested in this, been working on it a little bit over a year now, Adam, you will be relieved to hear that it's moved to copy editing stages.
Fantastic.
Which means I won't be able to as often say, sorry, the books got me down. I can't do
this.
Yeah,
what are you going to do when you don't have that excuse anymore?
I
got to
come up with something new. I've got about a month, I hear, a month before I get feedback from the copy editing phase, and then things will get a little crazy again. So,
okay.
So I'm all yours for the next few weeks.
Very exciting for that reason. Very exciting as well that the book is in that stage and that it's coming out at all. We will, of course, have a lot more details about that. I'm just hoping I can get a signed copy at some point.
I got to figure out what the prices are
yeah,
for that.
What's the charge?
And if you can afford them.
Okay, fair enough. We will link to more information about pre-ordering Josh's book at filmspotting.net as well. On our website is where you can participate in our poll question goofiness. And a couple weeks back, in anticipation of this show, The Magnificent Seven, all the Denzel Washington talk, we talked ourselves into giving you two versions of more or less the same question. What is Denzel Washington's best performance, and what is your favorite Denzel Washington performance? As we expected, the results did come out a little bit different based on the wording of the question.
First, I have to say, this torturous experiment made me realize something about our top five lists.
Okay.
Essentially, what I do is I pick my favorite for my number one, and then I try to convince myself that it's the best, right? So this, so having to separate those two here was very, very difficult.
Okay.
Of course, my pick that I was struggling over came in last place in both of the polls. So I don't know what that says. That would be He Got Game. In the Denzel Washington Best Performance poll, it received 4% of the vote. That was followed by Inside Man with 5%. Flight received 11%. Other, right here in the middle, with 13%. I think Glory and Man on Fire were the most popular answers.
For sure, in that order.
Okay. Then up at the top here, Training Day for the best Denzel Washington performance received 29% of the vote, but it was Malcolm X winning with 38%.
Okay, then on to the favorite question. He Got Game, last place, 8%. Flight, 9%. Inside Man, 12%. Malcolm X, third, down from first, 18%. Other jumps up to second with 23%. And there it is, not a surprise to anyone who heard everything W. Kamau Bell said in the previous segment. Favorite Denzel performance coming in number one, 30%.
Yeah, he sort of predicted that, didn't he?
Yeah, and then this speaks to that same wording point we've been making as well. When you look at the results of Other, that 23%, Man on Fire, first in terms of most popular other response, Glory second. So it switches a little bit when you consider whether it's more fun to watch Denzel be the ultimate badass that he is in a movie like Man on Fire, or is that one of his better performances. You can parse that however you want.
Yeah, it seems like maybe that's what people were thinking of, favorite as fun.
Yeah.
When answering this poll, which makes sense. We heard from Chris Massa, that would be, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm not sure if I can narrow it down to just one performance, he says. Denzel has given so many great ones, but I can definitely narrow it down to one movie. Of all these films, I feel safe in saying that Malcolm X is the best and the one most likely to stand the test of time. And at the film's center is a great performance. Passionate, subtle, larger than life, deeply human. Is it Denzel's best performance? Probably. Is it the role he'll be remembered for? Absolutely.
Our guy Billy Ray Bruton. It's so rare when I don't have to vote other in one of these polls. He hates the way we come up with these options, I guess. But you managed to include both my favorite Denzel Washington performance and my favorite Spike Lee-directed film, the highly underrated and surprisingly powerful He Got Game. Saw this film when I was 16 and it blew me away. So much raw human emotion on display in virtually every scene, and the film never goes quite where you expect it to go. Washington delivers a subtly heartbroken performance that also finds space to sizzle with ferocity and anger. It runs the gamut in terms of highs and lows, and no one can do it better than Denzel. So glad you guys included this film as an option, and though I doubt it will win, I hope it encourages more folks to check out a Spike Lee film they might have skipped when it was released because you thought it was about basketball. It is, but it is also about so much more than that. Obviously, we both agree with Billy Ray's comments there.
Right there with you. Also heard from Brad in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin.
Oconomowoc?
I'm going to go with Oconomowoc.
Okay, you do it.
I think I've been there. Denzel is always solid and reliable, but there is only one time he has ever wowed me, and the option isn't even on the list. I had to go Other for Glory.
That tier does have to count for something. Kevin Scrugg says you can't ask about Denzel and not include Devil in a Blue Dress. We second that notion as well.
One more here from Taylor Cole. Best has to be Malcolm X. There's really no question there. But I'm happy to see Other leading for favorite, as it indicates that Washington has had so many different enjoyable favorite roles among the film spotting listenership. For me, the favorite has to be as Coach Herman Boone in 2000's Remember the Titans. It's my first memory of Denzel. I was 10 when the movie came out, and it remains the most quintessentially Denzel performance for me to this day. The perfect balance of humor, swagger, and genuine gravitas. He is the primary reason that movie manages to strike that same balance so well. Hashtag strong side, left side, hashtag zero funds, or hashtag we want some mo. Do you follow all those hashtags, Adam? Have you seen Remember the Titans?
I do, but I have to add one of my own, hashtag Taylor, you're wrong.
Oh.
I don't know why we're ending on this note, Taylor. You're bringing down the whole segment here about Denzel, that we're ending with love for Remember the Titans. I was not 10. Maybe I wasn't in the wheelhouse for this movie. It was, in fact, Josh, I remember it, the third movie I ever wrote a review of.
And you trashed it?
It was definitely a two-star affair.
You came down hard on Remember the Titans.
Ryan Gosling being in that film and Denzel being in that film, I'm not a fan of Remember the Titans.
Well, you hadn't come to appreciate Ryan Gosling yet.
That's true. Nowhere close. So, just kidding, Taylor. I love that you got in a movie that otherwise no one else brought up.
3 out of 4 stars for me, Taylor. It's okay.
Oh, of course it got 3 out of 4 from Josh. Okay, that brings us to our new poll question. The Chicago International Film Festival opens in a couple of weeks. It is, I think, the 13th of October. We are going to preview that. A lot of great titles coming to the fest this year. We are going to do our own preview of the fest on next week's show. A lot of great stuff coming to highlight, including a lot of stuff that's been generating buzz at other film festivals as far back as Cannes in May. So for this poll, we decided to focus on the word international. And we're not going to come up with a second version of this poll unless I'm missing something here, Josh. We'll see what happens, I suppose. But we are asking you, which film from abroad playing this year's SIFF are you most anticipating? Here are your choices.
Let's just keep it to one. There's a lot to chew on here.
Yep.
We're starting with The Commune, which is the latest from Denmark's Thomas Vinterberg, made The Celebration, The Hunt, and last year's Far From the Madding Crowd. This is about the clash between personal desires and solidarity / tolerance in a Danish commune in the 1970s. The next movie is Elle from Paul Verhoeven, stars Isabelle Huppert as a successful businesswoman who gets caught up in a game of cat and mouse as she tracks down the unknown man who raped her. Moving on to Graduation from director Christian Mungiu. He made 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, and also Beyond the Hills. I think both of those were on top 10 lists of mine for those years. The Handmaiden comes from Park Chan-wook, who's behind the Vengeance trilogy, including Old Boy, and he recently made his English language debut. We reviewed it on the show, Stoker.
Mm-hmm.
So The Handmaiden is coming from him. Ken Loach will be part of the Chicago International Film Festival with I, Daniel Blake. Now, this one was the winner of the Palme d'Or at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Loach, of course, did win That Shakes the Barley. Another film of his is Sweet 16. Two more films we're going to offer you as options here. A Quiet Passion is actually the second Terrence Davies film of 2016. We reviewed the previous one, Sunset Song, here on the show. A Quiet Passion is a biopic about Emily Dickinson, played by Cynthia Nixon. And the last option comes from Iran's Asghar Farhadi, who made The Separation. It's called The Salesman, and it's the story of a couple whose relationship begins to turn sour during their performance of Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman.
Okay, so 7 really strong options there. I can say, as I've started to work on my list of most anticipated, that none of these 7 films are my number one.
Okay.
Though I am highly anticipating all 7 of them. Do you have a clear favorite among these options?
I think I'm going to actually set these aside from my anticipated list and look for some other titles. But I think the one that for sure would be on there if I wasn't doing that is probably Mungiu's Graduation. His films have just wowed me in the past. And so that's where I'd go first here.
Yeah, that would be high up there for me. But no surprise, it would be The Salesman. Because of Farhadi, because I'm fascinated by his work and the work of a lot of contemporary Iranian filmmakers, but also because of that meta aspect, you know, I'm drawn to that. I love we get that intersection between reality and fantasy, between their real lives as people and the characters they're portraying on stage. It just seems so in keeping with so many of my favorite Iranian films. So that's the one I am most anticipating out of this list. We want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net if you leave a comment, and we hope you do. Please let us know where you're listening from.
Took a job, looking for some men to join you.
Is it difficult?
Impossible.
How many you got so far?
You and me.
Who's she?
We work for her.
Good Lord.
That's right.
That man murdered my husband.
I want something. I take it.
He will take everything we have.
So you seek revenge.
I seek righteousness, but I'll take revenge.
A clip there from the trailer for The Magnificent Seven, the 2016 edition of The Magnificent Seven, starring Denzel Washington. Josh, Bill Hader tells a funny story about the first time he ever played Vincent Price on Saturday Night Live. It might have been in dress rehearsal, but I seem to remember him saying, like, right as he was about to go out to actually do the performance for the first time, Lorne Michaels came up to him off stage and said, and of course here I wish I could do Hader's Lorne Michaels impression, I like this, but why now? I like this, but why now? Also, my immediate reaction to pretty much any remake I hear about, especially remakes of classic Hollywood films from 50-plus years ago. Is the answer purely commercial, or maybe convenient is the better word? John Sturges' 1960 The Magnificent Seven, itself a remake of Akira Kurosawa's The Seven Samurai, offers a simple, compelling plot, one perhaps worthy of regular recycling. Desperate villagers turn to a group of gunfighters to protect them from ruthless bandits. replace then up-and-coming charismatic Hollywood stars like Steve McQueen with current up-and-coming charismatic Hollywood stars like Chris Pratt, sprinkle in some new faces and round out the colorful crew with a few heavy hitters like Ethan Hawke and Vincent D'Onofrio, who aren't afraid to spit a little scenery out with their tobacco juice, and you just might have a hit. Is the answer tied to one star in particular? A necessary marriage of actor and role? I'm thinking a little bit of the rotation of hot British men who every 10 years or so have to play Hamlet, right? We have to get a take on Hamlet from Ralph Fiennes and Tom Hiddleston and whoever the sort of flavor of the month is, all, of course, very fine actors. But in other words, is there something so iconic about Yul Brynner's alpha Chris Adams that this generation simply needed to see a once-in-a-generation actor like Denzel Washington portray him? Washington's stoic leader, renamed Sam Chisholm, would never be so ostentatious as to proclaim, "King Kong ain't got shit on me," you know, assuming an 1870s cowboy was familiar with King Kong. But Chisholm is so stealthily badass that I reckon even Training Day's Alonzo Harris would be awed and afraid of him. Or is the answer a matter of material and timing? Eli Wallach's Calvera, who is a bad dude to be sure, but more or less just wants to steal the villagers' crops because it beats growing them himself, has been replaced by Peter Sarsgaard's greedy, megalomaniacal industrialist Bogue. Maybe yet another Trump stand-in, Josh, that we've seen recently on screen. The hired guns this time are protecting working-class Americans, not Mexican peasants. And even though race is not directly commented on at any point, the group's leader, played by the Russian-born Brynner, who's referred to at one point as a Cajun, is now, of course, played by the African-American Washington. So, Josh, do any of these potential answers apply here? And if not, how do you justify the 2 hours and 12 minutes you spent with the Magnificent Seven?
I can't. I had to review something for this week's show.
That bad, huh?
this was a real drag. I'm listening to all your potential reasons, and they make sense on paper, which is why maybe the studio thought they made sense. Obviously, the prerogative is we have a familiar property that's easier to sell than an unfamiliar property. That's mm-hmm. why we don't get original material convenient. From Hollywood. It's convenient. It's marketable. So that's your real answer. There is a plot worthy of recycling here because it is so elemental. And I'm sure many other movies have recycled this in variations
right.
that aren't obviously indebted to
the Seven Samurai.
So that's one reason. Denzel does get it touched on this very briefly with W. Kamau Bell, this through line in his career of exploring the limits of righteousness or what righteousness means and how it maybe works against revenge. We start to get that at
right.
the very end in his character, where there's a moment of revenge in a church, no less, which will give you some idea of, you know, how heavy-handed this movie is overall. I think the element of race, or maybe diversity is a better way to put it, is what they were trying to go for. Maybe that's what Fuqua wanted to emphasize, not only in Washington. And when he does come to town the first time, it's clear that this is why everyone's looking at him sideways, right? They make that obvious. But also in the casting, you know, the fact that you have – normally, I would celebrate something like this, that the Seven are made up of many different ethnicities.
Yes.
But it almost feels like they were working from a studio note checklist where it's like, now we need someone who's like this. Now we need someone who's like this. And once they had those people, they stopped thinking about it. You know, it was like they were trying to meet quotas, not explore characters who had individual histories or cultures that could bring something, unless you want to count the fight between two Native Americans that I'm guessing is probably more insulting
yeah.
than anything.
Like, you knew it was coming only
just,
because
yeah.
it felt appropriate for the film.
Oh,
you knew it was
yes.
going to do it.
Yeah. So I think if that's an intent, they bungle that. I just, this should have been more fun. And I think Vincent D'Onofrio offered a hint when he comes barreling into this thing.
Well, there's a great line, right? Is it Ethan Hawke's character or is it Pratt who says, "I think that bear is wearing man skin"?
Yes, that is a really good line. It's
yeah.
Pratt. It's one of Pratt's good
yeah.
lines, who otherwise I think is entirely out of place. I mean, I love Chris
He's
Pratt.
He's being Chris Pratt. It's the Chris Pratt we've seen in everything.
Yeah, and it didn't work in Jurassic World. It doesn't work here. The charisma has its limits, I think, we're learning. But D'Onofrio is, you know, he's the guy who realizes this thing is a drag. I don't know when he came in, but it's almost as if he knew what the finished product was going to be and retroactively fitted his performance to say, I got to wake people up. I got to be as loony as I can. He bursts out of this bush. I think he throws a hatchet first. So he's following the hatchet, takes two guys
running.
And he looks like.
And that voice.
I mean, well, the voice is the kicker. It's how he looks first. I'm trying to think of how I described it. What he first struck me was it's almost like he's Grizzly Adams who's eaten Orson Welles. That's what it struck me
as. Yeah, or he's got asthma or something.
And then he unleashes this voice, which is like,
I'll say a prayer for you. You know. A little prayer
from this huge barreling guy. So that is just outright ridiculous, but at least it woke me up.
Okay, so I only saw your comments on this insofar as your letterboxed little jab at this movie, where I think you said something like guns and hammo.
Yeah, that about sums it up.
Which I assumed you were referencing like hammy acting. And so I thought that maybe you were actually going to argue that one of the problems with this film was performances like D'Onofrio's. And I was all set to argue with you about that because I actually think his performance is great.
Desperately needed it.
It's one of those that only an actor like D'Onofrio can pull off. We've seen him do similar things in other roles. He's one of those guys who approaches material never in a straightforward fashion. Some people try to do it. I've said this, I know, a million times over the years, but my guy now, Brad Pitt, who I do like as a leading man, but when he tries to be a character actor like that, he can't do that. D'Onofrio can do that. D'Onofrio can put on a voice, he can put on the outfits, he can do any kind of character role you want and make it broad and make it bizarre, but still make it grounded in the universe that we're seeing on screen. And I think he's a lot of fun.
This thing is not grounded. What he's doing here is not grounded in anything going on screen.
No, but I think I still believe him as a man. I believe him as a man in that world.
Okay.
I do. Totally.
Okay. I can't go that far. I appreciate the performance on the level of, like I said, that it woke me up. I don't think you would start there and say, follow this as a model to make a good Magnificent Seven.
No, and I don't think some of the cast could do it.
This is a terrible Magnificent Seven, but at least I have this to watch.
Okay. Well, we disagree on this movie a little bit, which is to say that I definitely had more fun with it than you. I actually had enough fun with this movie for the chunk of its running time that I thought I was going to recommend it to people. Not wholeheartedly, not like you need to run out and see this movie, but it is a great storyline. It is a compelling cast. Maybe I have more of a tolerance for the Chris Pratt charisma thing that we get on screen, whether it's new shades of him or not. I still find it mostly pretty fun to watch. I really love, once again, Ethan Hawke in this movie. So I found most of it pretty enjoyable as kind of boilerplate Hollywood remake of a familiar but still compelling plotline. What really put me over the edge, Josh, with it was the last 30 minutes or so, where Antoine Fuqua, the director here, just lets the movie devolve into a storm of bullets and bloodshed. And it's unsatisfying, really, in every way I can think of. There's nothing interesting cinematically about how it's rendered, but it also, and hey, a little bit of spoiler here, I guess, it so devastates the town and the people in it. I said bullets and bloodshed, that by the time you get to the end of it, you can only wonder, was any of this worth it?
Yeah.
There's nothing left to say. There's no one left. There's no town left. You almost wish they had probably just all sold their land or bought their land from the bad guy Bogue, Peter Sarsgaard, in the first place and avoided all this. And you look at their faces and you wonder that they might be thinking that as well. Actually, in thinking about it today, Josh, I realize that it's so extreme that maybe I'm not giving Fuqua enough credit and the screenwriters, including Nick Pizzolatto from True Detective. Maybe that's the point. Maybe they're actually making a really, really cynical statement that they went down this path of violence and bloodshed and look, it only made it worse.
Okay, well, if we're going to give them the benefit of the doubt, we could say in their defense that Seven Samurai, the Kurosawa film, ends.
I don't know what movie you're talking about. I've never seen it.
You didn't get to it. Okay, sorry. I wouldn't have hung you out to dry like that, except that there is a parallel here, okay? The famous final sequence in Seven Samurai.
Don't spoil it.
Okay.
You've already spoiled it.
No, Seven Samurai. Doesn't spoil it, okay? It's a magnificent film.
I don't care how old it is.
There's plenty to appreciate in it. The final battle ends in this rainstorm that creates this mud, and it is that idea that everyone involved is being sucked into a pit of despair, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But in Seven Samurai, it's much more existential in how that is expressed and what it is really about, whereas this is so literal because they use so many bullets and it never ends. It's astonishing to me. And I got to share this with you. I saw this with my grandfather, right? I took him. The guy's 93. And he turns to me during this section. Overall, he liked it. Okay. We walked out. He thought, oh, it was pretty good. But he turns to me and he goes, this is more than the Second World War. And keep in mind,
he was there.
He was in the Navy in the Second World War. So he knows what he's talking about. He couldn't take it either. I mean, it's just overwhelming. And I don't think it's only that last sequence either. Fuqua's staging of these Western archetypal moments is so drawn out.
Yes.
And overemphasized. And I think this undermines Chris Pratt too. I mean, I don't want to put a ton of the blame on him here, but he has a few sequences where he's supposed to be facing off against these guys and he's going to trick them, right? These things are drawn out so long, all of the suspense just whistles away from the scene.
I don't know. I know which one you're talking about, and I liked it.
With the cards?
Yeah, with
there's
the cards.
There's a couple of them. There's another one with the guy who took his horse, and the ones with Denzel as well. These standoffs are so poorly staged. And I know they're trying to evoke the classic Westerns.
Yes.
But it doesn't have the same sort of pacing and rhythm that those did.
Well, let me give you one counter to that. And here's where I thought early on I was going to be in sync with this film and in sync with what Fuqua was doing in terms of that staging and choreography. The first shootout we see in this film, not a conventional Western shootout, but it is the opening of the film when we meet the Peter Sarsgaard character. He comes and lays down his edict to these townspeople in the church. And then outside, one of the main characters just can't leave well enough alone. He has to say something to Sarsgaard. He has to admonish him. And Josh, in that scene, maybe it went by so fast you didn't appreciate it, but I loved it because it was one of those sequences where it wasn't long and drawn out. It wasn't given this protracted kind of old school Western approach. It was just a scene where in the blink of an eye, about seven bullets are fired and some people are dead on the ground. And not only did I think it was pretty great in how it did all flash by so quickly and how with a couple quick cuts and some camera moves, Fuqua captured that, but it also did capture for me, if we're going to give this movie any kind of timely relevance at all, just this sense of how quickly something like that, a disagreement like that, can go south in a hurry. Like I just did. I really did start to imagine some of these campaign stops, right, where you've got the people outside shouting at each other and it starts out as they're just making some kind of snide comment, and the next thing you know, someone's being punched or they're trying to hit people. I felt like I was seeing something in that moment escalate so quickly that captures something sadly fundamentally human in how fast those kind of things can escalate.
Well, that one is indeed shot and edited much differently than most of the standoffs that there are. I think I was just distracted by Sarsgaard's performance, which is shortly behind D'Onofrio's in looniness. I mean, he's like quivering the whole time in terms of this villain that just did not work in any sort of
doesn't.
Universe.
And I was able to kind of pinpoint why. It didn't work for me to begin with, but I did just last night finish watching the original Magnificent Seven, a film from 1960 I've never seen in its entirety until now. Have
so
you
good,
seen it?
Right? Yeah. Love it.
It is really good.
Yeah.
And no, I still didn't get to the Seven Samurai. All I will say by way of apology is I really did mean to. Keep in mind, not only did I have to watch both of these Magnificent Sevens, I had to watch the Boonwell films, and I did fit in Glory, which is a pretty long film. So I had some homework to do for this show.
I approve of your prioritizing.
Thank you. I will get to it. I can't wait to get to it. But in watching the 1960, The Magnificent Seven, you see the difference in the villains, right? Sarsgaard, for whatever reason, maybe they feel like they need to just amp up the stakes. They turn him into an almost comic book villain. And there's a line that, again, I watched this movie first. I waited to watch the original until after because I didn't want it influencing how I reacted to the new version. But there's a line in the new one where Sarsgaard says, if God didn't want them sheared, he wouldn't have made them sheep, referring to the townspeople. Turns out that line is in the original one as well. Eli Wallach's Calvera says that exact same thing about them being sheep.
If God didn't want them sheared, he would not have made them sheep. What do you say?
But when it comes from his mouth, it comes across as just kind of general disregard. Like, he cares so little for these people, they might as well be sheep.
Yeah,
but when Sarsgaard says it, yeah, it's totally an aside. When Sarsgaard said it, it's like this Nietzschean claim. He's proclaiming his dominion over not just these townspeople, but all people he deems unworthy of his status. He is a complete megalomaniac. He's God in that scenario.
He's Loki. He's and playing him as Loki.
He is. And you know what? It adds nothing. And speaking of Loki, it just makes the whole thing more hokey than anything, that completely doesn't work. But otherwise, like I said, I was with some of the staging, I was with some of the performances, and as I mentioned about a month or two ago here on the show, I do generally go for putting the band together movies. Mm-hmm. So when we get that 30 minutes or so of just putting the gang together, gathering the Magnificent Seven, I bought it.
You're going to love Seven Samurai then.
Yeah.
I think it's like about 50 minutes of the film.
Okay. Can't wait to finally see the Seven Samurai. And genuinely, I have been thinking about the fact that, especially knowing that we both had this mixed to very negative reaction to this movie, I lamented that we didn't just decide to talk about the Seven Samurai instead.
That would have been
why
fun.
Why didn't we just devote this segment to that film? In retrospect, that's what I'd do.
The Denzel tie-in, you know. We got
to
say, too, Denzel's stride, which we didn't get into with W. Kamau Bell, but I think that's one of his defining qualities is just his walk.
Yeah.
Perfect for this movie when he's walking down Main Street, right? I did like that.
Everything about how Fuqua depicts him, all the little rhetorical flourishes, it's straight out of classic Hollywood. But that said, the movie doesn't regard Yul Brynner at all the way that this movie regards Denzel Washington in terms of our introduction to him, the way he walks into a space and we just see little bits of him to develop this kind of mythology about mm-hmm. him. It makes him the baddest man alive, Fuqua does with this film. Yul Brynner is a really formidable presence
right.
in that film, and we definitely see him as the leader of this group. But when we're introduced to him, he's just a guy standing over against the fence
yeah.
who injects himself into a situation. It's just really fascinating to watch how much attention and how far Fuqua goes to try to elevate Washington to a mythical status.
You tell Bo, if he wants his town, come see me.
Magnificent Seven is out now in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. Quick plug for our friends over at SVU. They've got a review of The Witch, one of Josh's favorite movies of the year, or was it your favorite of the year so far?
It wasn't the favorite, but it was in my top five at the mid-year point.
Top five. There you go. It's newly available on Amazon Prime, plus highlights from Matt and Allison's trip to the Toronto International Film Festival. Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, the art house in your house. Learn more at rentmoviesondemand.com.
It's not The Witch, but we are going to move on to a different sort of horror next. Sharpen those razor blades. Our Luis Buñuel marathon kicks off with L'Âge d'Or and the notorious Un Chant Andalou. Stay with us.
We've been fortunate the past few weeks, Josh, to have multiple sponsors on the show. That has meant that we haven't been able to single out all of our great listener donors and subscribers, the people who really are the lifeblood of the show. But the donations and those monthly donations have still been coming in. So we wanted to get to those names, those locations, and a few comments as well. We start with Eduardo Valladolid in Spain. We also heard from Bjorn in Portland, Oregon. And we're just spanning the globe here, Josh. Aaron in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Hey guys, just wanted to say congrats on reaching 600 episodes. I've been a listener for about 3 years now and figured it was time I contribute a little more. Your discussions of movies are what make me look forward to long road trips and have helped me pass the time on sluggish jobs that I've had in the past. Film Spotting has even served as a motivation for a college radio show that I put on with a friend called Cinema Addict. We play movie scores, soundtracks, and clips based on a theme chosen each week and discuss our thoughts on the movies we explored. Our next episode is going to cover the films of Jim Jarmusch.
That sounds great. Thanks so much, Aaron, for writing in. Cinediction was one of the names Sam and I considered when we were coming up with a replacement name for Cinecast. Obviously, we did not go that route. We have a new Silver Club donation from Brian in Valparaiso, Indiana. And this one was a fun one. We saw a comment from Noah as well on Twitter, Noah, N-O-A. She says, "Hi, Josh, Adam, and Sam. Today, a longtime dream of mine came true. I've been listening to Film Spotting regularly since the 500th show and have caught up with at least half of the shows before then. I'm now sitting at the AMC Theater in Chicago, about to see Sully, and can't wait to listen to the latest show on the way back. I thought this was the perfect opportunity to thank you for a great podcast, which supports and inspires film lovers like me. I really appreciate your insightful comments, personal approach, and never-failing sense of wonder." I think that, well, we're certainly trying to capture that each episode. And here's why this is somewhat of a dream for her, why this is interesting that Noah is taking in a movie here in Chicago. She is not from Chicago. She's visiting. She's living in Berlin, Germany, and she's originally from Herzliya, Israel.
That's a relief, Noah. I thought maybe the dream was to see Sully, and that would have been very sad indeed.
I might be making this up, and I wouldn't put it past me because I just like having allies, but I'm pretty sure she wrote on Twitter that she was hashtag Team Adam. So,
well, good. If she if she came all the way to Chicago to see Sully, movie. I hope she likes it.
Fair enough. We have a new $10 a month donor as well, Robert Casaneo, or Robert Casanello. He's in Orlando, Florida.
I first heard about Film Spotting from a Dana Stevens recommendation on the Slate Culture Gabfest. But I was hooked when you took down the Benz at the Movies review of Synecdoche, New York. Periodically, I teach a podcasting class at the University of Central Florida and assign Film Spotting to my students when I go over production and formatting. And the only directions I provide them is best podcast ever. Never had a student disagree.
Wow, that's great. Thank you, Robert. And we have heard from a lot of instructors over the years from high school classes, college classes, who have used bits of our show or whole segments of the show to help explain what podcasting is or get into criticism. And that's always really rewarding to hear about. We close with a gold level donation that comes to us from James in Ridgewood, New York. "I've been listening to Film Spotting since 2009 and am embarrassed to just now be donating to what is hands down my favorite podcast. I work in the film business and feel lucky to have assisted on a few films that you guys have reviewed. While getting to work on movies is a dream come true for me, it can sometimes be a grueling experience. You're often expected to work 12 to 14 hour days and the pressure can be high. When jobs like these come up, it's easy for me to lose sight of what made me fall in love with film in the first place. Luckily, Film Spotting exists. Your show reminds me of the joy I felt as a teenager, standing in theater parking lots with my friends, talking about what we just saw, what it meant, and why it matters. There's that sense of wonder, I think, that Noah was referring to. It's that wonderful feeling you're left with after seeing a great movie, and you get to enjoy just thinking about it. I can't thank you enough for all the great conversations and hard work you put into
nice
making
James.
A show that helps me remember why making films is worth it. I also wanted to let you know that my first feature film as a director, a sci-fi thriller called Diverge, is going to be showing at the Tall Grass Film Festival in Wichita, Kansas, on October 16th at 4 p.m. If you'd be willing to mention it to your listeners, I'd be grateful. And if any Kansas film spotters can make it out, I'd be happy to add them to the guest list for my screening. I know we have a few in Kansas, Josh. They can reach out to James on Twitter. He's at Morrison Film, or on Facebook at Diverge Film. And more info about the Tallgrass Film Festival can be found online. We will put a link to that in our show notes at filmspotting.net.
Congratulations, James. Hope the screening goes well.
We do indeed. A no-cost way, of course, to help the show. You can rate or review us on iTunes. Our iTunes overlords do seem to pay attention to these kinds of things, so thank you for taking the time to do it. Wanted to thank a couple listeners who, over the past few weeks, have shared reviews. Christina108 and BH9870, who just started listening to the show last month. To Lee Ansky, who's been listening for 3 years, and to R.P. Moitozo, who writes that after listening for 10 years, Film Spotting is more than a podcast. Adam and Josh feel like good friends of mine who provide a reliably thoughtful conversation each week.
Oh,
that's what we're going for.
That's really nice of a cocktail drink to say.
Is that a cocktail
drink? I think I've
drink?
Had an R.P. Moitozo. We barely had time to replenish our electrolytes from our last Film Spotting marathon, Contemporary Nordic Cinema, And we're off and running on our next one, the films of Luis Buñuel, which we're exploring in partnership with Mubi. We'll be getting to the two films available on Mubi soon, Robinson Crusoe and Death in the Garden, but we're going to start appropriately with the first two films of Buñuel's career, Un Chant Andalou and L'Âge d'Or. I'll come right out and say I think we've already got one masterpiece here in Un Chant Andalou. And then, well, I'm not entirely sure. L'Âge d'Or, which is less a collection of surrealistic imagery and more of a pointed satire, raises a question I think we're going to have to wrestle with throughout this marathon. And it's one I've already seen a few listeners who are playing along with us on Letterboxd ask. How much will our appreciation of these films depend on knowledge of the historical, political, and religious context in which they were made? Watching L'Âge d'Or, which has obvious targets in the upper class and organized religion, yet attacks them in very idiosyncratic ways, I almost wondered if my detached experience might be something like that of a person watching Mike Judge's Idiocracy 100 years from now. So they'd vaguely understand what was being spoofed, but there's no way they could appreciate the particularly incisive and timely ways that Idiocracy operates. So before we circle back to Un Chant Andalou, can we talk a little bit about how we plan to approach this question of context when it comes to the films of Luis Buñuel?
Well, forget all those very specific references that you alluded to. How do we contextualize what we are seeing scene to scene, frame to frame in these films, right?
I mean, so fast.
There's little to no plot. There's certainly nothing conventional in the way of structure, the term that's always thrown around. He collaborated with Salvador Dali on Un Chant Andalou, so you, of course, approach these films from a surrealist standpoint. There's nothing realistic about them. And no matter your background, any viewer, I think, is going to find themselves on somewhat shaky ground. The quote I saw in a few different places was from Buñuel talking about, I think, Un Chant Andalou, saying, "No idea or image that might lend itself to a rational explanation of any kind would be accepted."
Yeah, I saw that
one too.
So
that's your starting point, right? Then here we are.
I guess it's kind of freeing in a way.
It is kind of freeing, but exactly. We are, as any viewer would, trying to make sense of what we're seeing, trying to connect scene to scene, moment to moment. And
which wasn't meant to be connected.
No, it was never meant to be connected. So it's doubly difficult when you're here then, after already going through that experience as a viewer, then from a critical standpoint, trying to piece it together. It really does elude you. I do think it's maybe heightened, of course, because Buñuel's stuff is so loaded with commentary. But in some ways, Josh, it's not that different from any other marathon we've tackled that explores film from a particular country or region. You think about the preoccupations and social mores of Scandinavian countries and how different that is from Iran or South Korea or the India that we see depicted in Satyajit Ray's work. The only option I think we're really left with is to consider the movies. The movies themselves reveal the foundation to us. Let what we see over a course of a few movies provide that context. So with Buñuel, I think it's even more true because it's all about what we see and how we question what we see. And let's keep in mind, these are both silent films.
That's
so
true. Yeah.
They're even more, let's say, cinematic, for lack of a better, more appropriate term there, but they're all about how they're constructed visually and how appropriate it is then that the most infamous Buñuel image is that early shot in Andalou of the eyeball being sliced. And the Catholic Church that's so dominant in daily life in Spain at this time, that's a church that's built on iconography. It's all about the power of images. Jesus on the cross, the garments the priests wear, the grandeur of the churches themselves. There's a certain authority that's implicitly granted to those images that we as people, that the believers in these countries grant to those images that I think Buñuel would say we simply take for granted. And he comes along and challenges that, forces you to question everything you see, to recognize the seeing can be a painful act and certainly not just a passive one. And I go to the ending of L'Âge d'Or, where we go from a party scene randomly at this big estate to a castle sort of thing out in the middle of nowhere. And the titles tell us that there's been this orgy of depravity that took place inside, where you've got lots of women in there and some of them are inexperienced, but some are highly skilled in debauchery. And Buñuel, whether out of some sense of propriety or budget or whatever, he doesn't depict any of those acts.
Right.
He just tells us what happened inside behind those doors. But then what's the first image we see? Who emerges from the door first? A man who is not Jesus, but who very clearly is supposed to represent Jesus. Maybe the closest depiction of the typical visage of Jesus I've ever seen on screen. That's what this guy looks like, exactly. And then we go from that to the final image of a crucifix, but of course not any kind of crucifix we've ever seen before. It's adorned quite differently. So you talk about context, imagine the reaction that must have provoked.
Oh, sure.
This sequence must have provoked in its audience. Forget the authorities, just in the average viewer. Is he making a statement about the hypocrisy of the church? Is he simply trying to provoke, to shock, to make the audience question things? Maybe both. That's the beauty of Boonwell.
Yeah, I think that, you know, in terms of that figure, we should also say who looks like Jesus is given, I believe, the name of a character from a Marquis de Sade
right.
novel. And so these are sort of the peeling back of the references being made that I'm talking about, is to try to figure out, okay, what is the end game here? Take some knowledge of those references. And I think that these two films are very distinct in a way, because Andalou is exactly as that quote describes. It's just this series of random images that part of the artistry is seeing how each viewer puts different associations to it, right?
Yeah.
But L'Âge d'Or, there are specific targets here. I mean, you know, when you are working with that iconography, which I think is much more prominent in L'Âge d'Or
yeah.
than it is in Andalou. Andalou has, you know, the two priests who are being pulled by the wagon in that one quick flash. Mm-hmm. But really, there's more of it in L'Âge d'Or. And that's where I'm trying to figure that if there is a connection that's meant to be made, you know, I feel the burden of trying to make that before I render any sort of – before really – even knowing, like, well, how upset should we be about what's being – you can't be upset about what's being said here until you know what's being said here. Mm-hmm. It's going to be very difficult to figure out what's being said here. That final image of the cross where there are, we'll just say, scalps hung mm-hmm. on it, nailed on it. You assume those are from the kidnapped young women. I mean, I'm familiar with the term, your sins being nailed to the cross. I don't know if that's what Buñuel's going for here, but he's definitely evoking those sorts of things.
Right.
So at the very bottom line, you recognize the power of the imagery that he's using, the twofold power of the original imagery and then the way that he's, whether it's subverting or commenting or however he's using it, the artistry that's involved there mm-hmm. is amazing to behold. Now, I found that to be much more effective in Andalou mm-hmm. for – and here just separate from any sort of messaging issues, just in basic craftsmanship terms. At L'Âge d'Or, I felt like some of the jokes, even though I didn't entirely get the context, were sort of drawn out. This is about an hour, we should say. Andalou right. is about 17 minutes. And you kind of get what the joke sort of is mm-hmm. well before the scene ends, whereas Andalou is this dreamlike barrage of imagery that I was just entirely captivated by. I had never seen that infamous image of the eyeball in its entirety, that mm-hmm. sequence. I'd obviously seen the image and maybe a flash of it here or there, but I hadn't watched the entire sequence.
Right.
Didn't realize that we go from the razor about to cross mm-hmm. the eye to a shot of the full moon with a tendril of clouds crossing the full moon faster than they would. So there's some surrealism even going on there in what is ostensibly a documentary shot, the same direction as the razor.
Right.
Then we cut to the close-up where I believe it's a calf's eye has mm-hmm. been replaced and you actually see the slice. Just sort of the creativity of inserting that makes me realize we're in the hands of a master here in a very first short film mm-hmm. of deciding to do that. So overall, I think it's the way that Andalou moved that made me realize I had seen dream movies before mm-hmm. that sort of captured what dream logic might be, but this one had dream rhythm, and mm-hmm. I don't think I'd experienced that before.
No, it does, and I saw your rating on Letterboxd. You gave it 5 stars. I wish I had had that strong a reaction to it. I definitely think that Andalou is the more essential of the two films and highly recommend it, and it's funny that you talk about that razor scene and not just the shockingness of it, but the matching of the cut there, no pun intended, because I rewatched the beginning of this earlier today, just hoping for some little bit of inspiration. What was I going to say about these films that are so yeah. hard to talk about? And I'd kind of missed it the first time. I think maybe I got so caught up in the angst of watching an eyeball being sliced, but also how fast it is.
To see it.
Yeah, the rhythm of it that I didn't the first time notice it. And this time I noticed the way, you're absolutely right, the movement of the razor starts right to left on screen. Then he cuts to that moon and the clouds passing, exact same motion. So it feels exactly like that razor moving horizontally. And it's not just a great bit of cinematic magic, but it does seem to me in some ways maybe encapsulate what makes Buñuel so fascinating as a filmmaker, where there is something in juxtaposing those images, in intercutting them, we get at once pure horror, something horrific that really does make you feel aghast, and something beautiful. What's more beautiful than the moon at night and the clouds drifting by.
It's subverting that idea.
It is, right? So we have horror and beauty mingled together. We have the mundane. We have a face, an eyeball, a razor blade, everyday items, and something magical, the moon at night, and then the earthly and mingling that with the heavenly. It's something I know we're going to see play out even more as we get through these films, and there is something wondrous about it. I was going to say that that context as well, Josh, not only comes from the cinema that we're watching here sort of in real time with this marathon, but from the cinema of other filmmakers and Buñuel himself. I feel like I have enough of a base to know where Buñuel is going to go because I've seen films like Pasolini from Italy, another country, of course, that is similarly steeped in Catholicism. And you have a filmmaker like Pasolini subverting that religious iconography and taking as many jabs as he can at the bourgeois and at those authority figures, especially at religious figures. And then the Buñuel films that I've seen before, Belle de Jour, Exterminating Angel, Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, Vera Diana, these are all films that are about sexual repression and various taboos that he's exploring, subverting again religious authority and iconography. Think about Vera Diana. I've talked about the Last Supper shot from Vera Diana, where he really does restage it quite blatantly, but with lepers and beggars and people who are not, let's say, the cream of society. And think about how many of his films revolve around people just being thwarted from carrying out their most basic desires. The dinner party where guests can't leave, a group who's trying to eat dinner but can never get served. And in L'Âge d'Or, we see a couple of sorts basically trying to copulate, and they're always being thwarted. And it seems to be whether it's their family or whether, of course, it's the church or other members in society. So you get a glimpse that you know how these things are going to play out a little bit if you've seen some of his other films.
Sure.
But then all the other films in this marathon I haven't seen, so I can't wait to see the variations on those themes.
Well, how about in Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, the couple, the married couple who are the hosts,
oh, yeah,
who are also trying to get it on and keep getting mm-hmm. interrupted. So that's if there's a plot to L'Âge d'Or, it is that couple played by Gaston Modeau and Lya Lys. And, you know, it ties into the sexual repression thing that is obviously there. And I went in search of more because I felt a little bit adrift. And I wanted to share something I found at Senses of Cinema that talks about this in an interesting way. It was written by Derek O'Donohue. He basically suggests that the movie imagines what might happen to people whose sexual desires have been repressed by religion in general and Catholicism in particular. So O'Donohue says, the Catholic Church and other institutions of power in the film work to oppress individual desire. Those who benefit from the oppression are immaculately suited mannequins, so the bourgeois, insensitive to imagination and the inner life. For those who desire in such a society and find themselves kicking against it, the world is turned inside out. And that does make sense to me and even ties it in with that end sequence you're talking about at the castle, where if repression is this widespread throughout the society, it's perverted things to this degree. Mm-hmm. And then in the final shot, he's tying that all again together with Catholicism.
Yeah.
So there's just so much going on
right
here to try and unpack.
The other common trope, I guess, I saw physically in these films and visually, obviously, in both, was the way he focused on hands.
Yes.
And it made me think of Bresson a little bit, though he renders hands quite differently uh-huh. than Buñuel does. But you can pray with hands. You can commit horrible acts with those hands. The hands are, at least this is what I perceive to be the way Buñuel perceives them, they are extensions of those earthly desires. They're what allow you to act out on them. And so he does seem preoccupied with them. I am curious if that's going to play out as well.
Well, they're agents of intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we see here in Andalou, where not only the severed hand on the street that they're all looking at, but also the one with the hole in the palm that the ants are coming out of.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. That's just terrifying. But then you have the most Andalou image in L'Âge d'Or involves a hand. And it's when Madeau is stroking her face.
Yeah.
And
it's all of a sudden deformed.
All of a sudden, his hand turns. The fingers are kind of turned down. And at first you think, well, that's a weird way to stroke her face. Then he turns the palm, and it's obviously an insert shot of someone else, and the fingers are missing.
Mm-hmm.
And most of L'Âge d'Or doesn't work in that extreme of surrealist manner, but that moment absolutely did.
Okay, so just one final note here, a little bit of production business. We got an email just before I watched this movie, actually, so it did influence me. Cole Bauer, a listener in Minneapolis, wrote in, and he said, after sitting down to watch this again for the first time in years, Un Chien Andalou, I noticed there were a couple of different versions floating around. I had no idea there were different ones. I watched both, 16 and 21 minutes, and boy, is there a difference. The restored version, 21, is really cleaned up and without the tango music, and certainly the preferred view, Cole says. So I'm sure there's a good chance you already know this or someone's tipped you off to it already, but just in case, I wanted to let you know and provide a link on Vimeo with a little background. Thanks, guys, and looking forward to the episode. So there is an article we'll link to in our show notes if you're curious for more. I did follow this link. I watched the Vimeo link, and I watched the 21-minute version restored, and that's what actually sent me back not only some inspiration, but I wanted to see how different the 16-minute version was today when I was preparing, and it does look quite grainier, and it's a little less vivid, I would say, in the non-restored version, but that's on YouTube. The 16-minute version, and then this 21-minute version also is available for free on Vimeo. So we'll link to both in our show notes if you want to watch them.
And here's where you get into the maze. So I ordered a copy from the library, and it was, I want to say it might have been 17 minutes. The picture was fine. The restoration was fine. There was music. I don't remember it being tango music. So either way, it worked on me.
Mm-hmm. So the start to our Buñuel Marathon. Again, this marathon presented by Mubi. Their curators introduce a new title, and you have 30 days to watch it. That means there's always 30 wonderful films to enjoy, all for only $4.99 a month. You can use their mobile app to download films and watch them offline. And our listeners can try Mubi free for a month. Just go to Mubi.com/filmspotting, MUBI.com/filmspotting. Never a better time than now to sign up for Mubi, as I think the next two films in our marathon, including Robinson Crusoe, which is available right now, those are both on Mubi.
Death in the Garden is the other one.
There you go. That's it for this show. Please send your comments about Buñuel or about any other part of the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. That number available on the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter. Josh is at Larson on Film, and I am at Filmspotting.
Also at filmspotting.net, you can find 11 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives. Those are in the show archives. And while you're there, vote in the current Film Spotting poll. We're asking, what is the most anticipated international film playing at this year's Chicago International Film Festival? And if you haven't already, please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show. They've been on a little bit of break, but are coming back next week, I believe. And Film Spotting SVU, where Matt and Allison did just review The Witch. You can find both of those in iTunes or through your favorite podcast app.
Out in limited release this weekend, Operation Avalanche, the mock documentary about faking the moon landing. White Girl, well-received at this year's Sundance. David Ehrlich calls it an adrenalized shot of ecstasy and entitlement. Out in wide release, Deepwater Horizon, Peter Berg's take on the 2010 disaster with Mark Wahlberg. Masterminds, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, Tim Burton's adaptation of the young adult fantasy bestseller, and The Queen of Katwe with Lupita Nyong'o and David Oyelowo. It's directed by Mira Nair. It's about a young girl who overcomes her disadvantaged upbringing in the slums of Uganda to become a chess master. Next week, though, for us, the big topic of discussion, The Birth of a Nation. It opens on Friday, October 7th. We will be discussing it on next week's show, as well as highlighting some of the films we're most excited to see at this year's Chicago International Film Festival.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dussault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.